Hello there. This is another episode of the Golden Age of Serial Murder. I'm Toby, and with me is Simeon. Today we'll be diving into the 1970s, which saw an unprecedented increase in recorded serial killings, while also diving further into the origins of serial killers and the psychology and clinical criminological practice on mass and serial killers. To help us with this is Jennifer Murray, who is a criminologist at Indiana State University. Her research interests include mass and serial killers and the origins of violent crime. She's lectured in both the US and Europe, and she's written many articles, including work on transcendent fantasy in mass and serial.
Today we're going to be looking at it within the context of the 1970s, the wave of crime in the post-war era, the greater sociological questions, and we're very happy to have a guest on who can help explain everything. So how do we start off with this, Toby and Jennifer?
First of all, thank you for having me. Okay, my name is Dr. Jennifer Murray. I'm a professor at Indiana State University. My research is on mass and serial murderers.
Well, one of the reasons that we definitely wanted to bring you on was that we've had two episodes thus far, two and three, where we took a more panoramic historical and scientific view. We've had two since then that were more focused on cases, a little bit more narrative focus. We don't want to totally lose that, but we want the audience to understand the importance of why you have to get into the weeds a little bit with this. And I think to start off, maybe the reason we decided to focus on this period was because in the United States in particular, when it comes to crime overall, and especially serial killing, it really is extraordinary from the late 60s, early 90s, and particularly when you see in the 70s. But I've also read that overall crime booms in the 60s, in part because you have all this, you know, you have the chaos, the cultural tumult. But it doesn't seem like, it seems like there different types of crimes begin to accelerate in different, like maybe there's some in the 60s, but then some in the 70s and some even more in the 80s. How have you seen, how in your telling of this, is this, did this happen? And what are your initial thoughts about why?
We were at a time of great unrest entering into the 70s. I think there are numerous factors to why this started to increase. One is the availability of targets. It was commonplace to hitchhike. A lot of women would hitchhike. There were lack of security systems in homes. Serial murder wasn't really on the radar yet in the early 70s. We didn't have a real accurate comparison prior to this. Our criminal justice, police, law enforcement systems were not as sophisticated. So we didn't have the tracking of prior cases like we do today. So it may not have been accurate before this time period. We certainly didn't have systems to help catch them at this time. So you tend to see killers get on with their killing for longer periods before they are caught during this time. There were other factors that were taking place. We had stagflation in the 70s. We had a lot of political unrest because of the Vietnam War. There was a lot of experiment with drugs. So there were kind of a lot of factors that were at play that may have been a part of it. When you talk about serial murder, you have to realize there's no one explanation. There are multiple factors, and every case is different. There are many overlapping things, but each case is different. And we do not have a single cause for serial murder.
And crime was a particularly big issue at the time. It wasn't just that crime was felt and understood and crime was increasing. It had a wider cultural effect. The 1968 election between Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon was actually run on law and order, as you had the Newark riots, the riots in Watts. You had the cultural tumult, as both of you have articulated, and And actually, crime started to rise between 1963 and 1974, actually doubling, or the homicide rate actually doubled by the mid-1970s. It was fluctuating between 8 and 10 murders per 100,000. Again, the questions about the strength of pre-1960 collection of data in terms of crime, but it was something that was felt not just politically and into the 1970s. Actually, on the national level, crime became less of an issue, especially after Watergate, and the Republicans became, despite running on law and order, the Republicans actually became associated with some political crimes. But at the municipal level, crime started actually becoming a really big issue, especially in New York. It sort of started to shape the way New York was perceived. And there's a significant amount of drain from cities into the suburbs, in part inspired by this increase in crime. And then obviously you see an increase in crime of all kinds, with serial murder being a particularly unique and special kind of crime that starts to increase in this period. And the public knowledge of serial killers really becomes known in the periods in the 70s that we're talking about.
Definitely.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting when you talk about the effect, and I think the outsized effect of things like serial killers or mass shooters or terrorism or even something like a shark attack. It's always bigger than people, you know. You'll have people say, well, the stats are this and comparisons is not as much a problem as something like, you know, a huge problem like heart disease or something, but which is true in a sense, but it builds on itself and it affects the psyche on a deep level. And I remember I think most people have some relationship. This has nothing to do with why I got interested in this, but in a slightly related note, my mother grew up in Lincoln, Nebraska, and she remembers very clearly, this was not a serial killer, this was a spree, but she remembers when the state locked down due to Charles Starkweather and Carol Ann Fugates going on a rampage. That was something that was new at the time, inspired a lot of movies. The entire United States state locks down because of two people. And then you see the Son of Sam, you know, take control of New York a couple decades later. When you look at these type of crimes, it seems to me that you can't possibly overstate the psychological impact of them and then how they play into all these things that are feeding them and are fed by them. It's not one cause, it's not one result, but it seems like that it's actually a mistake to underemphasize the importance of these things, even if statistically, especially because, you know, the world I grew up in, the America I grew up in, was a much more fearful place than the one my mother grew up in large part because of all of that, those kind of crimes. She never let me out of her sight because she was a little bit maybe pretty overprotective. But when I was a kid, there was the little boy named Jeffrey Curley in Boston who was taken by two pedophiles. The whole city, the climate changed. It became so frightened and so angry. So it seems to me to be of incredible importance when you look at society, at the health of a society. It's not just, I think, an idle fancy. It's not just a small thing.
Well, the media is getting that message out. So spreading that. And that really began with Jack the Ripper. That's when the printing press came out. So they were able to, that's when it really started, that kind of fear and knowledge of what was happening. I think with these crimes, it's the brutality and the randomness of it, that it's so out of control that gets everyone. The odds of it happening are so minuscule, but yet it happens, you know, with the people. And it's the media has turned it into such a big thing. And we can't get our head around it, either serial or mass. And so it's a big, they've created a lot of fear, tremendous amount of fear. Now, when you talk about guns in the United States, about 40,000 people die, or kill themselves by suicide. 40,000 people. And we lose, you know, a couple hundred in mass shootings in a year. I mean, we lose people with guns in so many other incidences than mass shootings. But the one we talk about is the mass shooting. So
they seem to be separate, private things that don't encroach on people's personal comfort sometimes, you know. And there's when there was, you know, this is a little bit out of the focus of our time period, but when the man who shot Gabrielle Giffords, when it was discovered he was, you know, he was a schizophrenic, there was a little bit of the news coverage about the problem of schizophrenia. And that does seem to me also to be something that you see, that it's a bit of an issue in the post-war period, in terms of Ronald Reagan closing down mental hospitals, the misdiagnosis of a lot of people. But for a moment, there was an understanding that there's a huge population of almost entirely nonviolent schizophrenic people, not, you know, but who often went missing, or whose lives that were very stressful for the family, and that wasn't talked about because it was uncomfortable. But when people become frightened, it becomes their issue. They're not necessarily interested in it until it happens. But as you say, the media can turn a shower into a monsoon.
Yeah, and the thing with both mass and serial murderers, most are not, they aren't mentally ill in the legal definition. People that are mentally ill in the legal definition rarely harm anyone. They suffer from mental mood disorders, personality disorders, those types of psychological problems. And with regards to mass and probably serial, the behaviors exhibit themselves at a younger age typically, and we're missing them. We're not, what we do with a lot of these kids is we kick them out of school. And if they can't make it in school, they're not going to make it out of school. You know, we're not handling it properly at all. We need to get it at a younger age. With serial, it's a little different. I think they are developed into antisocial, sociopathic personalities at a very young age. But with mass, they're not all, you know, sociopaths or that type of person. They're narcissistic for sure, but there are different. There's different motivations.
What's your view about as far as that the antisocial personality, as far as particularly, you know, when the more extreme varieties of it, what's your particular interpretation? You said it being very early interpretation of it, of how determined it is by genetics, how early it manifests, how it relates to early, you know, very early psychological development. Because I'm someone who I have a little bit of a bias towards nature over nurture, but I'm not a scholar of this. I'm just an amateur. So I was, how do you interpret the nature nurture dynamic? Because it does matter also when you look at it in a sociological way as well as individual.
Yeah. Especially with different types of killers. Like how would you balance the nature nurture dynamic with different types of killers?
Yeah, nature versus nurture. It's a very tough thing to really really grab a real sense of. I believe that we may be genetically predisposed in some aspect. We don't really know definitively on that by any means, but you could have somebody that maybe has a predisposition, poor coping skills, something that they may be born with, and they have a very nice home and it counteracts that. Or they're predisposed and they have a horrific home and it doesn't counteract. We don't really know. I think we don't know enough about genetics yet to know whether it's that kind of, that biological has such a factor. I mean, certainly we are what we're made of, you know, and what we come from to a large extent, but how that plays into this is not as solid. It's real soft science. We don't really have a grip on that. There are other theories though that we really do. And I'm not saying that genetics is not a factor. I think it certainly is. It's just to what extent we don't really know. You know, sociological theories and psychological theories and rational choice theories, those are a little better ways to more explain how a serial killer develops.
Yeah, you know, I was sort of thinking about, you know, when you think about the terrible upbringing some of them have, and we've covered a couple of those in episodes with, but on the other side, you know, you think of all the people who grew up with those, you know, with those and didn't turn into violent people. I was watching some of Richard Pryor. Richard Pryor had a kind of a serial killer's childhood and became a comedian. But he grew up, you know, if you give him the antisocial genetics, he could become someone like the Grim Sleeper. Instead, he became someone who did have struggle with a great deal of emotional pain and interpersonal drama. But
he struggled with drug abuse as well.
Yeah, that exactly. I mean, he was a damaged person, but he took that and made something, you know, something poetic and funny about with it. But he did grow up in the kind of environment that you see a lot of serial killers grow, particularly the ones who target prostitutes, displacement killers for their mother or for someone like that, or who are abused by a John or a stepfather. He was, you know, he was physically abused. So it does seem like that when you have a genetic aspect, that can be determinative. The nurture aspect without the genetics, unless you have an extreme head injury, it seems to me that's the reason I was thinking about that. But in terms of the various schools of how you look at this within all those different, you know, you can look at the four basic schools of criminology. You can look, what were the other ones you were talking about?
Rational choice theory, and there are sociological theories and psychological theories. As far as, you know, Richard Pryor or somebody that's grown up in these horrific situations, most of them don't do this. They do not do it. Perhaps it's they have better coping skills. We don't think mass killers have very good coping skills. Obviously, serial killers don't either. And maybe they don't have that one person that was in their life that they got a break with, that changed something. You know, we don't know. I mean, we've got other types of, you know, antisocial, sociopaths, psychopaths make up about 1% of our population. And yeah. them aren't violent. Most of them are CEOs and often in politics. Bernie Madoff. One could say Bernie Madoff did more damage than a serial killer with all the people's lives he devastated. And many that made suicide because they lost all their money. So they come in all different areas. They do different things. They manifest it very differently.
How do you think someone develops better coping skills?
We think that sociopaths, I mean, this isn't really hard science yet either, but it's developed from birth to probably age 3 or 5. And once that shape, there's no changing it. And basically our needs have to be met from birth on. We have to be held. We have to know when our food, we're going to get food, that kind of thing. And if you don't get that, and on top of that, you get extreme abuse, then that can shape the direction you go. That's not to say that, obviously, again, that everybody that didn't get that is a serial killer. But the coping mechanism, I don't know. It might be genetic. I don't know. I don't know if that's a learned thing, if you learn that, or it is something that you are born with. That I don't know. But I do know that mass shooters and serial killers don't have that. They don't have that. Very poor coping skills.
Someone who kind of, you whatever box you put him in, And obviously he's had effects beyond just his crimes. But I was thinking, Ted Kaczynski, he seems like he was formed, that he became violent because he was in a hospital setting, quarantined from his mother at a really early point in his infanthood. And his mother said that he came back a totally different infant. Mm-hmm. And you see that similar with Kenneth Bianchi, a serial killer. And you wonder, you know, what might have been if that hadn't happened. But you also wonder, you know, if you take another baby and put them in that situation, who knows?
It might be. So we don't know the nature versus nurture definitively. I mean, Soon-Hung Cho, the Virginia Tech killer, when he was an infant, he had invasive heart surgery at like age 3, and he was never the same again. He didn't want to be touched. He was more off to himself.
Abdominal hernia surgery.
He had selective autism. They didn't diagnose that in him until he was 15. Wow. So, at a very young age, some of this is kind of set on a path.
Do you think, because, you know, you've offered us some insight, but you've also sort of the limitations of the criminological perspectives. Like we dealt with Germany in one of our episodes, and not only cook killers in Germany in the 19th century, but also like the way the German criminologists thought about killers and violence of all kinds. And they tended to think about it in a very sort of like nature focused way. You know, a lot of theories that I think they got from Lombroso, the Italian criminologists, were always focused on, you know, like that crime was natural to the criminals, and you had to try to find the difference between people who were, you know, who had might have a natural inclination towards crime but could be saved, and then some people who had a natural inclination towards crime and then should just be gotten rid of. But it seems from the way you're talking that criminology today in the contemporary sense is less confident about the different, not just different approaches, but what actually makes a criminal.
Yes, definitely. Those were earlier ways of thinking. I am very big on sociological theories and with this and how a person is shaped. I think the things like social process theory, learning theory, what we learn from our parents and those around us, control theory, social bonding. I mean, social bonding is huge, and mass shooters they don't have friends at all. I mean, they're loners and misfits. And serial killers are different in the sense lots of them marry and have a dual life. They carry this kind of thing on, but they have a marriage, usually a very strange marriage, but they do kind of the dual life thing. Mass, there's not much dual life. They're just kind of odd ducks. But it's that kind of, there's a process through this that happens. There's a researcher that I have admired over my career, doesn't get a lot of credit, Lonnie Athens. And he came up with a theory in the 80s called volatilization theory. And it's basically, and it's very simple, and others really talk about it as well. It's basically the abused becomes the abuser. And that's a very simple way to explain it. It's also Eric Hickey's premise, and what we all go by basically for studying serial killers is trauma control theory. And that is across the board, something we see with all serial killers. They've had multiple unrelenting traumas, and every single one I've studied. And that holds up. So this, it's kind of the social condition that they are born in and endure has a big part of it. And then the lack of coping skills. So sociological theories, I mean, with Ted Bundy, you always find something. With Ted Bundy, he was told that his grandmother was his mother when it was really his sister that was his mother. And he didn't find that until later. He also was very poor, didn't like that, stole things, wanted to present a life of being somebody more with money, higher socio status. And he wanted to marry a girl in college that was at a higher level status and wanted to fit in and pretend that he was of that class. So that was an economic thing that, bothered him and affected him. He felt relatively deprived economically.
One of the things I find Bundy especially fascinating as someone who's kind of like a skewed extreme, mirror of some of the issues, pathologies, structures of society. When you think of how he thought of himself wanting to be high status, a sort of a blue blood rather than poor. And the way he talked about it too, which we'll get into when we cover him more in depth in a future episode, but the way he talked about what it means to be an American, you know, to be invisible, to be disconnected, to be utterly your own actor, to the ruthless pursuit of possession as a to satisfy your narcissism. It's almost like an extreme version, a dark version of, in many ways, the American dream, not so much the white picket fence, but the dream of being bigger, of being richer, of being, the materialistic aspect of it. But you know, it's interesting because we, in our last episode, we covered Dean Corll, the Houston serial killer, and we couldn't, at least as far as we could tell, he seemed to be inscrutable as far as what might have caused it. You know, it may be that maybe like Bundy, he was very, very antisocial from the jump, but there didn't seem to be obvious social context except the extreme homophobia of the period. And certainly that's something that plays into this, because you see a lot more body count, a lot more, at least with gay killers. So obviously this would not be a topic for sociological interest if the society wasn't a major part of it. But it seems with control theory, when I look at that in general, which is the most kind of direct, it seems like it might have a problem with boundaries. It might have a problem with looking at something that might be more genetically focused, but also something that is a greater society-wide problem rather than just something that is within a slice. You could certainly, I think, control theory would be optimal for like understanding how gangs work. And it could certainly be understanding how serial killers work to a degree. But I wonder if maybe only after the fact, I wonder if it would have less ability as an analytical tool, or maybe I'm wrong.
Well, I think it plays into it. None of these theories completely, explain serial murder. It's a combination of them. We see commonalities in serial killers. When you're looking at control theory and social bonding, it's a social process theory. I think it has a piece to it. People that have bonded with other, if this is the direction you're going, I'm not sure it is, people that bond with other people, parents and colleagues and friends, don't do these kind of things. So it's a path that they're going, a process that they take, a road they take, and over time leads them to actualize these types of crimes. When you talk about Gacy's father made fun of him. I mean, he from a young age, you know, the gay thing was a big piece of this. Dahmer also, I mean, there was shame in it. And they, in order to be with men, they would have to kill them afterwards. The shame and the only way that they could see of really having sex with men.
I also think with Gacy, and once again, well, I'm sure we'll get into more depth in this in the future, that there's something classically psychodynamic about it, in that he seemed to, in his crimes, in his fantasies, to not just express his rage and frustration and having to not acknowledge himself as gay, but he seemed to take on almost the role of a facsimile of his own abusive father or men like that. He wanted to, it seems to me a lot of psychopathic or whatever term you want to use for that those people, if they're abused, they identify with the abuser because they're obsessed with power. Whereas someone who isn't like that, it seems they might become a social worker or a cop or someone who tries to stop that happening to other people. But people like Gacy, they want to be their father. They want to be the person with the power, and they want to be the macho, domineering, tyrannical figure and anything other than what they were.
That's to ensure they don't get hurt. If I'm the abuser, nobody's going to hurt me. Sure. Yeah, absolutely. That's why they do it. That's why they do it.
So Jennifer, you've talked about, with reference to Ted Bundy, you know, his fantasies of wanting to be better than he was, of a different class. And what role do you think transcendent fantasy really has in with killers and with different killers as well?
Well, I think with fantasy is a part of all of us, but I write about my term was that transcendent fantasy. This is the basis of everything. I mean, we think it before we do it. And with rapists, with mass murders, with serial killers, you fantasize it. You have to think about it first. And so you fantasize what it's like to do it. And you may start out as a peeping Tom or an exhibitionist. You know, they don't start out with just serial murder. It builds. It's somewhat like a sex offender fantasy builds over time before they actualize the crime. And then once you actualize the crime, it's never as good as the fantasy. So they're always kind of chasing their tail to get that high. And so it builds and gets harsher and harsher what they do to people as the fantasy goes on. And so every single mass killer, serial killer has done this, and it's a long developing process. And some of us have healthy fantasies. You know, you want for a career. You know, I thought for a long time, I want to get my PhD. I want to do a certain thing. You can't just do it. You have to think about it first. And the fantasy process for these people transcends them towards this actualization of what they're going to do. And they're also going to transcend the world. Mass killers, you know, they're going to transcend this world in a hubristic way. You know, they're going to show, I've been minuscule and not noticed my whole life and don't have any friends. Well, I'm going to show you, I'm going to get you all, and I'm going to hurt this group of people, and I'm going to hurt all the people that love them. And I'm going to have a say in when I go out. I'm going to control that as well. And that's kind of the thinking and infamy along with that, which was kind of started with Columbine.
You know, one thing that's interesting about the time when you look at the 70s, I was looking up, isolating particular parts of this time as far as what the crime rates and the changes and trends. And I always return to 1974 as kind of like, you know, and people think of different decades, not always beginning on the exact decade of the shift in that decade, but then particularly epochal shifts. 1974 is where a lot of things, you know, you have a lot more before that, but 1974, you've had Watergate, Vietnam has just ended. You have all the social unrest that spooled out from the 60s to the 70s. All, you know, you have some level of social trust, but also some level of deep disillusionment. One thing I noticed, since we're talking about mass killers and serial killers, is that there was not just a fair number of, you know, a lot of violent crime and a lot of serial killers, but there was a fair number in 1974, in particular 74, 75, 73, that kind of bridged the gap between that and kind of exemplified what you just said. And some of them played into, some of them fit into some of the social tumult and movements. There was the Zebra murders in my birth state of San Francisco, which was came out of a cult, out of some of the Black nationalist movements. There was this guy I read about, Thomas Eugene Creech, who went on this big spree. He was associated with the Hell's Angels and with the occult, there was this guy, Paul John Knowles. He was a kind of a glamorous looking figure. He goes on a spree throughout the country in 1974, eventually gets gunned down. And you think also how that connects to some of the ideas, the popular myths of the 1970s. So many movies like Bonnie and Clyde, or Taxi Driver, exploring the alienation of young veterans. That all these things, they play into each other. And it seems like, so while we think of that time as serial killers, it also had a fair number of mass shooting. It had things that combined and then coalesced with all the other social factors that were happening. It seemed like it was all there in an extreme level.
Yeah, yeah. There are a lot of things that play into the fantasy. So certainly film in that world may pique somebody's interest. We don't know, it's a direct causal effect. Yeah. But the media, when we have these mass and serial killings, provides fantasy tools for them. I mean, it's right there. They fantasize about being that person doing that. It's a roadmap for them on how to do it. They eat up every detail when it's covered in the media. So we hand them fantasy tools to spur them on. Absolutely.
And just to give some broader context than the 1970s, so in terms of serial killings, but 605 serial killers were going to be identified in the 1970s, twice the number of the previous 20 years. 88% of known American serial killers in the 20th century were kind of really between the late 60s and the 1990s. So this is a huge boom in serial killing, really starting in the 1970s and going up significantly in terms of not just violence, but also serial killing in 1974. And I think part of what you guys have been talking about, I think the increase in celebrity culture probably might also aid this as well. The move away from like a collective understandings of self in the 1960s and hippie culture towards more like celebrity culture and a lot of people like Jennifer has alluded to wanting to be seen as, you know, as doing something, you know, bigger than themselves, perhaps feeling within this more atomized 1970s sort of culture where people have more individual control, but when people aren't necessarily doing anything that's great or grand, perhaps fantasizing about being, you know, bigger than themselves and being involved in something that is significant as well. I think that perhaps it plays a role in this period. It might be why, you know, you don't necessarily see, because I mean it's a real increase. I mean you have as many serial killers identified in that decade as you do in the previous 20 years. So it's a real increase. And to find out why, I think is particularly interesting.
Yes, definitely 70s, 80s. I might have actually peaked in the 80s, but 70s, 80s, and 90s. Yeah, I mean, outdoes what is prior and really what's been since, I think. Those numbers, they are huge. Yeah, so the fantasy is a big part. The other two things, though, every single serial killer I've studied is a psychopath. They have antisocial personality disorders, every single one. Not the case for humans. They are definitely narcissists, but not like that of a serial killer. So there's absolutely no empathy in serial killers, which is a piece of this. And they dehumanize their victims, and masks do as well. But it's a different type of animal. Other thing that needs to be known about what all of these, the ultimate thing that we have to recognize is really rational choice theory. And ultimately, we weigh things that we do, and these people, the ultimate thing is they choose to do this. No one's forcing them to do this. This is their choice. That is the thing that separates them from other people. They choose to do this. And they're very aware of it. They're rarely mentally ill to the legal definition. They're very aware of what they're doing. They absolutely know that from right and wrong. And they choose to do it. But due to the and then wanting the infamy and being something that they're, to get out of what I call their nothingness. They are in a state of nothingness, and they want to, the whole planning of this event puts a Band-Aid on their, I talk about their fractured identity. They don't know how to be a person, be different, but also fit in. And so the planning of their big event, particularly with mass, takes them out of the miserable world that they're in. It puts them into a second world of fantasy, puts a Band-Aid on their injured self, and that is comfortable for them. And so, I mean, Columbine spent almost 2 years planning their mass shooting. And so they get lost deeper and deeper in the fantasy in that world, and it feels good, but that also leads them closer to actualizing the crime. I compare it to a suicidal person's fantasy process to a suicidal homicidal person's fantasy process. They're exactly the same, except one is intrapunitive and one is extrapunitive. The suicidal person blames themselves, the mass killer blames everybody else. But they fantasize about the gun. what they're going to do with it, what the gun to the head's going to feel like, what people are going to think about them after they kill themselves, or what are they going to think about after they kill all these people. They fantasize exactly the same things, and the fantasy leads a suicidal person closer and closer to actualizing their behavior as well.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because, you know, when we were first, in our first episode, we took a look at a prototypical serial killer from a little, slightly right after World War II, which was Harvey Glattman. And that was the exact rule, that's that the reasoning I had about him, which was that I thought that his idea of kidnapping and tying up women and photographing them and then eventually killing them, and what that the whole thing was kind of a, that he had no, he was an fundamentally inadequate person. He had no ability to do that, but he could for a moment become maybe not a functioning human being, but become kind of the god of the moment, the god, you know, a god figure whose being was filled by that kind of power. But it's interesting you compare it to suicide. It's interesting to me that you look at criminology's roots in sociology. I think of the godfather of sociology, Emile Durkheim, how his work started looking at suicide, but then he had a theory that was more expansive to look at the you know, and I'm curious what you think what you think of particularly of his anomie theory, but also of strain theory, of those general veins, and how those can be applied to this, even if they don't necessarily, even if every serial killer or spree shooter is different. It seems to me that you could look at a context, let's say, you know, right now in some ways, or the 1930s, you could apply a strain theory framing, and it seems like you could apply it, Durkheim's work very much to the 1970s. But I'm curious, if you see those as being important or connected to this in any way?
Absolutely. Strain theory, absolutely. Negative experiences, just like we look at trauma control theory. Strain theory is a summation of negative experiences and how we handle them. Look at history or bad economic times. I mean, in the 70s, we had stagflation. I mean, during the stock market crash in the 1930s, 38, can't remember exact year, devastation, high crime. When in 2008, we had the housing debacle. Right now, we are in economic disarray. And there you tend to see a lot more crime during these things. Also, I think coming out of a pandemic, while we were in a pandemic, a lot of people, mass shooters, certainly didn't really have anywhere to go to do these shootings. And now that we're out, I knew that they would be kind of on the increase. We were all isolated, and mass shooters are typically more isolated to begin with. So I kind of felt it was going to have an effect on it as well. So strain theory, anything that is causes someone to struggle, definitely has a part in this, for sure.
And that cultural strain is felt significantly in the 1970s, as you said, with stagflation in New York. You have a regional fiscal crisis. You have a government-appointed board that takes over the finances of New York, drains the city of its social services, and you have this incredible uptick in crime. And then you have someone like Son of Sam as well, you know, who's living in the Bronx and commits six murders in 1976 and 1977, but also kind of develops into a little bit of a celebrity. He's the Jack the Ripper of New York, and in some ways internalizes that as well. So you have a strain in the culture, an uptick in violence, but also like an individual who wants to be, again, he wants to be seen as, you know, something bigger than self. And then the media that's kind of swells that up in the 1970s as well.
Yeah, there are actually four types of serial killers, and he would be under a visionary. He was actually being told, I thought, by the neighbor's dog to kind of do this, voices and that type of thing. And there are mission-oriented serial killers. That would be like Gary Ridgway, maybe thinking I'm going to rid the world of prostitutes, something like that, or these people that we think very little of. that kind of the living dead, we may refer to them. And they're hedonistic types of killers, which would be your Ted Bundy, your BTK, many, many hedonistic serial killers. And on Power and Control, you will find Bundy crosses categories. I mean, Jerry Ridgway, they're both hedonistic and under Power and Control. Pretty much across the board, both serial and mass are all about power and control. I mean, this is all about not having power and control, and they want it across the board.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I've read that the FBI thought, among others, thought that the Son of Sam was, you know, Berkowitz, that he was making that up as an excuse, that he was actually driven by, you know, this something very much like Ridgway, you know, a hatred, a displaced hatred of women. I wonder, though, if in his case, in today's world, he might be a mass shooter, because he can get that. It seems like, you know, in today's world, you can get that power, that control, that narcissistic validation so much faster. It kind of fits our society where everything is everything needs to be delivered in the, you know, as soon, quickly as possible. But, you know, what's interesting about serial killers is that, you know, they're much more, in general, much more deliberate. In general, they and it's also that there's such an obvious sexual component to all these serial killers' crimes. But we don't necessarily see that in all of the spree shooters. Do you think that there is something that is displaced in there in terms of sexual frustration, or do you think it is unique to the serial killers and maybe in some ways very particular to the post-war era psychology?
I think there's sexual frustration in many mass killers, if not all. They are misfits and rarely have partners. Elliot Rodgers is the poster child for this. His 144-page manifesto was all about not getting a woman. Couldn't understand. Did videotapes. I don't understand. I'm good looking. Why doesn't a swarty girl like me? These people. He was online in a group called the Incels, which is an online group for men that can't get women, and then go on this line on this website to disparage women. And he was on that website. He was even too extreme and had too much hatred towards women than the people in that club, and was kind of ostracized from them. But I do think most of these guys, a lot of it's about women. Now, they don't always go and shoot women. I mean, George Sedini, the LA fitness shooter, did. He went into a, not Pilates, but some sort of class, yoga or some sort of class, turned off the lights and killed the women that were in there. But anger can be displaced. They may have it towards one certain person or entity or group, but people that they end up shooting are kind of proxy victims. They're who they could get a hold of. And I definitely think that this is, when we're talking about maximum, more, I want to outdo kind of thing in our society. I want to be the greatest. I want to be known for this. Masses seems to be the way to go. I mean, it's getting all the attention, and serial used to, but really it's just all about the mass killing now. And I've put people potentially could have, this might've been the choice they made. It very well could have been.
It seems like sometimes also serial killers, some serial killers such as Dennis Rader, such as Berkowitz, you know, and the Zodiac, they want the attention. They want to play games with law enforcement or whatever. There also seems a lot of serial killers, particularly the really effective ones, the really scariest ones, I think stayed under the radar, and their entire motivation was personal psychodrama, was it made power and control, yes, but not necessarily in terms of how the world saw them. They lived in a universe of one. I think of, you know, you think of Ted Bundy crisscrossing the country. It's fitting to me also a figure who sort of looms over this, but we don't have enough information, Toby and I, to do too much on this guy. Samuel Little, who it seems like the number one guy.
Yeah.
Started in 1970, kind of right there, right at the beginning of the 70s, drifting around the country. And it seems a big part of this is the new highway system, the new car culture. you have all these drifters, you know, people, you can have a much greater range of victims. Isn't that a huge part of this?
Well, yeah, highway killers and trucker killers became a big issue. Yeah, and I mean, hundreds of people were disappearing from truck drivers crisscrossing around the United States, and they couldn't put them together because there'd be a person dead here and then it'd be a whole nother city, you know, miles away. And they took them a long time for them to figure out that it was truck drivers that were responsible for a lot of serial murder in the past. When you talk about Samuel Little, I mean, my gosh, I mean, 3.5 decades this guy killed for. I think they actually know of for sure 61, and he says over 90, which I kind of believe him. 93
yeah,
or so.
I do too.
You see, the thing is, they recall, and he's proof of it. They recall every moment. He can draw all the pictures of each woman down to what they were wearing, their expressions. They remember this. That, you know, the fantasy. They want to maintain it. So they take trophies. They can tell you about each murder, you know, maybe not the name because they want to kind of put that out of their mind because that's a way to dehumanize them. But Dahmer kept body parts in his locker at the candy factory. They keep these things to relive the high and the fantasy and keep it close to them for as long as they can. And then it's not enough and they have to kill again.
And I think when you mention the highway system, I think that's particularly significant because you don't tend to see as many serial killers emerging from the climates in the Northeast. A lot of serial killers are coming out of California, which has a particularly like dispersed highway system where, you know, people need to own cars. And so you're seeing in the 1960s, you know, you're seeing people like the Manson killings, and then into the 70s you're seeing the Hillside Stranglers and things like that, really coming out of California, where there is a lot more hitchhiking and where there is a sort of a bit of a freer culture, but also more of an opportunity for men like that to use those opportunities to kill people, I think.
Long haul trucker killers were a big issue. And this was fairly recently. I want to say early 2000s that the FBI took that on, trying to make truck stops safer. There were women that were prostituting themselves at truck stops. They used to call them lot lizards and would be abducted and taken. And it was a big thing. I mean, like 500, it seems like, people over a fairly long amount of time that they can show were killed by long haul truck drivers. So it was a big deal over a couple decades until they started to make a lot of changes there and recognize it. It took them a long time to figure out what was happening.
It seems like if there's a lot of serial killing, you said, that might still go unreported, I would suspect that the heavy majority of that is the truck drivers, and also perhaps in areas that have less, you know, that have less internet access, because, you know, cell phones make a difference. I've read a lot of people women who are still approached in a lonely gas station on the highway in some less populated state by a couple people in a van or by a trucker. Certainly when you look at the truckers, I think we'll probably might do an entire episode a lot about this guy. There, you know, Robert Ben Rhodes. I think he may have killed over 50 women. And one of the things I thought was crazy about truckers is some of the ones who are violent deviants. They have nicknames for each other, kind of like you saw with some of the networks of pedophile priests in the Catholic Church or pedophile cells in the 1970s. It seems to be a real problem within an environment, and truckers, of course, they travel a very long ways, but they do have a community, and of course, many truckers are really cool people. But you know, obviously, if you're not, it provides an incredible opportunity. And also, it seems like the drifters, they put up. We don't know how many Samuel Little killed. I tend to think in his case and a lot of other cases, the higher estimate is correct. But, you know, the guy who started around 1974, Carl Eugene Watts, he may have killed a black visionary killer. He may have killed 80, you know, Bundy. Some have said Bundy may have killed over 100. Rodney Alcala, some have said the same thing, but they only proved 8. You wonder, though, that they had so much opportunity and it's all they care about. You figure people who travel the length and breadth of the country, you figure that the higher estimate is sadly correct.
There's so many more serial murder cases that we are unaware of. I think the numbers have to be much higher. They're underreported for sure. I mean, for one, you look at the type of population that's being killed, and you can categorize them as kind of the missing. When you're killing prostitutes and drug addicts and runaways, people aren't missing them. They're gone, and they're gone for long periods of time. People don't know what's happened to them, and then it's a long time until they even figure out, well, they're really gone. What's happened to them? Or even start thinking about what's happened to them or looking for them. So I think these crimes are far underreported than we think. And depending on the area that their disposal sites are, you know, where they're getting their victims from and where they're disposing the bodies can have a lot to do with what they get away with and what they don't. So yeah, always, this has been an unreported type of murder, underrepresented, underreported, and we really don't have a read on it.
Some of these ideas in a more embryonic way in our old episodes, especially because we're doing the historical periods, but it's really great to have an academic on who can explain some of these things and like where the field of criminology really is on a lot of these things with a number of different killers. And yeah, like I hope that we can have you back to actually interview you on something you've actually written.
Oh, love it.
In the future, yeah.
I'm particularly interested in that and what your work on Stephen Paddock.
So from myself, from Simeon, and from Jennifer, goodbye, and wait for the next episode of the Golden Age of Serial Murder.